You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 1st of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from here in Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
This is not about some profound statement that they disagree, some kind of big moral argument. This is about literally wanting to stop any proposal by Obama going through.
Washington, D.C. puts up the no vacancy sign. John Owen and Brett Mason unpick the government shutdown in the U.S. Then, what happens when all niceties are dispensed with in the media? We'll look right here in the UK and over to Australia. We're also at the British Georgian Film Festival to witness an amazing revival of the Georgian film industry.
The Georgian character is very much about showing yourself very strongly. So they're great extroverts. They like acting very much. And so they're naturally very suited to be in films.
And we'll meet the director of our neighbourhood Atlas Gallery for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe. All that plus music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24 on Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then on the next 60 minutes here on Aperitivo. Before we get started though, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who has the latest world news.
Large parts of the US government have been shut down, with up to a million federal employees forced to take immediate, unpaid leave. President Obama has blamed Republicans in the House of Representatives, who said they would only agree a new budget deal if his health care reforms were delayed for a year. In the meantime, museums are closed, as well as monuments like the Statue of Liberty and the Lincoln Memorial. Bill Holmes, who works at the National Museum of African Art in Washington, D.C., is one of those shut out of his job.
We don't know if we're going to get paid for these days that we're going to be off on furlough. We don't know how long the furlough is going to be. It's just a bad situation. And really, personally, as a federal employee, I think we paid our costs toward the financial recovery. I mean, we haven't had a cost of living increase in about 4 or 5 years. So this just complicates things.
An international team has arrived in Syria to oversee the destruction of the country's chemical weapons. It's thought the Syrian regime has more than 1,000 tons of toxic agents. It's promised to cooperate with the disarmament team in the country after an agreement between the US and Russia was sanctioned by the United Nations. Meanwhile, countries including France, the US and Germany have agreed to take at least 10,000 refugees from Syria's civil war. Antonio Guterres, who's the head of the UN's refugee agency, is hoping that number will rise.
The countries are the usual resettlement countries, but some new unexpected offers. There was indeed a very clear expression of a political will to remove obstacles in order to allow to speed these movements and to make them as effective as possible.
Senior members of Silvio Berlusconi's party are ignoring his call to topple Italy's coalition government. His deputy in the Party of Freedom says MPs should support the Prime Minister, Enrico Letta, in a confidence vote on Wednesday. Mr. Berlusconi threatened to bring down the government, ordering his ministers to resign at the weekend. It followed moves to expel him from the Senate over his conviction for tax fraud. A week after authorities in Kenya moved to end the siege at a shopping mall in Nairobi, religious leaders have said prayers for the 67 victims. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, told the multi-faith service that religion would unite rather than divide the country. The militant Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab says it was behind the raid. The Anglican Archbishop, Eliud Webukhala, spoke at the service.
We are saddened by the recent slaughter and maiming of so many innocent men, women and children here in our capital city. We now feel fearful, insecure and traumatized in our public places.
An MP from the main opposition party in Bangladesh has been sentenced to death for war crimes dating back to the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. Salahuddin Qader Chaudhry is the first member of the Bangladesh National Party to be tried by the court. His supporters say the trial was politically motivated. Sweden is the best country in the world in which to grow old, according to a UN-backed study. It looked at the quality of life for older people in more than 90 countries. The report praised the support and help offered to Sweden's elderly. The picture is less good, though, in Afghanistan, which came bottom of the list in terms of its care for older citizens. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul, I just wonder, would you consider upping sticks and heading over to Sweden then? In the many decades from now.
In the many, many, many years from now. I mean, obviously, if you were in Afghanistan and growing old, you'd be thinking, how do I apply for Swedish citizenship? the outlook isn't quite as bad in London. Britain is 14th on a list of 91 countries.
That's a solid effort.
Not at the top. Germany's third. So there's also an argument for considering a switch to Berlin.
Why not?
But it's not as bad as it could be.
I like that. I'm taking that as a positive note.
We're not the best country in the world to grow old. We're not the second best, and we're not Germany. But we're not Afghanistan. Britain, not Afghanistan.
I like it. I might suggest that as a new tourism moniker. Paul Osborne, thanks very much. More from Paul later in the programme. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada City Cheche.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
You're with Aperitivo. The time is 2:07 in Tokyo, 18:07 here in London, 13:07 in New York City. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined in the studio now for their unique takes on the world news of the day by John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University London and Chairman of the Frontline Club, and by Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. Gents, welcome both to the programme. Thanks for being here today. We were hearing in the news there with Paul Osborne, today's news agenda dominated by government shutdown in Washington, D.C. Understandably, perhaps. Failure of the Houses of Congress to agree a budget has left almost a million federal employees facing unpaid leave. That's not something anyone would probably welcome. I'll speak to you both in a second and find out your views. Let's hear first, though, from Harry Reid, the Democrat leader of the Senate, of course. This is what he had to say before the deadline passed.
The House once again has attached ridiculous policy writers that are dead on arrival over here. I've heard this story before, in fact, just 6 hours ago. Republicans will once again threaten to shut down the government unless Democrats repeal Obamacare for a year. But once again, we will not relitigate the health care debate or negotiate at the point of a gun.
So that's Harry Reid. They won't renegotiate at the point of a gun. Who's to blame in all of this? Is that too simplistic a question?
I think it's rather an easy one to explain. Basically, the Republicans have decided they hate Obamacare. They're being driven even farther to the right by outside groups, outside their own parties, and they're prepared basically to go over the cliff.
But do they hate Obama as well as Obamacare?
Yes.
Is that the fundamental problem?
I think
problem
they do. Here? And you know what? You don't appreciate sitting here in this little studio in a system that's regulated, in which if I attack you and go in a partisan way, I can't do that. If we were sitting in the States with Rush Limbaugh, the talk show, most influential talk show host, or driving around listening to wannabe Rush Limbaughs, they would be attacking him relentlessly. He'd be the socialist. This is the end of America as we know it. It would be just a vicious attack. And you don't get that sense when you're not there.
But this doesn't damage just Obama. It damages America. This is hugely damaging for all Americans and those 1 million public servants who are now effectively, as you say, on an unknown vacation without pay. And this is the president has just said in the last few minutes that the country is being held to ransom over an ideological crusade. And the place to have that fight surely is in Congress. Now they're effectively holding Obama to ransom, and it puts him in a very difficult position. Regardless, the real loser out of this is America, clearly.
Well, so far the polls, if you believe the polls, overwhelmingly the American people are holding the Republicans accountable, and that's their big gamble. The FT's kind of banner headline on it was, you know, will there be a backlash in the off-year elections in 2014? And that really could come to bite them in the posterior, you know.
But it could too, equally, if they didn't take this action, if they said that they were going to take a hardline approach, that they were opposed to Obamacare and they didn't stand their ground, then they would be accused of selling out, folding, collapsing, selling out on their constituents.
What's crazy about all this, of course, this is the first day of the so-called Affordable Health Care Act actually being put into practice. You should be actually ostensibly able to go somewhere today in some state, and for the first time, if you're one of 50 million Americans without insurance and you're not employed at your workplace, to get care to be able to protect you and your family if something terrible happened. This should be a great day to be celebrating. If this was, you know, when it was launched in Canada or when it was launched here in Britain, this would be an amazing day. Instead, states are trying to deny it, trying to discourage people from signing up, and it's just a shambolic state of affairs.
It absolutely is. And I'll talk a little bit more later in the program about, I guess, what the rest of the world makes of this. It should be a day of celebration. Instead, it's one of undue concern. But just if we indulge in a little crystal ball gazing, obviously there's the debt ceiling, fresh threats later this month. We could be looking at, you know, another D-Day. How's this going to end? It doesn't seem like there's any conciliatory noises. There's a few reasonable voices on both sides, not many of them, but they're largely drowned out. Do you think that we're in a situation where it's just not practical for government to function? These divides are so bitter, they're so entrenched, the divides are so profound, there doesn't seem any way for anything constructive to happen now.
Well, I'm sure commentators would have been saying this 17 years ago during the last shutdown. It always appears like that. I think the longest one lasted maybe 20 days or so, maybe a few days more. Clearly, at this point, it doesn't seem as though there'll be any room for negotiation, but both sides have to take a hard line. Otherwise, nothing is achieved by this. So both sides, if we're simplifying it to that extent, need to stand their ground and argue their case and hope that in this age of social media and grassroots diplomacy, that people will rise up and really back in one of those two viewpoints. But I think most Americans, from the people that I've spoken to today in the States and also here in London, who are Americans living abroad, they seem really disillusioned with both sides. They say that Congress has failed them. That's what they're telling me, that they expected both sides to sit down and negotiate before it got to this stage. Now that it's happened, it's very hard to sit down and have those sorts of constructive conversations because both sides have so much at stake.
Remember, it hasn't really bitten in yet because we're only talking about 800,000 non-essential workers. So
that's
true. You were trying to get a visa, if you're trying to get your mortgage approved in a kind of tight deadline, you'd be affected. But for the great number of public service workers, the army, the military, the people working in airports, I mean, this isn't affecting the greater public at large. But also, Washington is a museum town, as an old Slovakian journalist said to me. So if you can't go to the national monuments and monuments everywhere, then it means you can't go there. You're not going to a nearby hotel to have dinner. So everything around it, the whole economy is affected.
There's a huge knock-on effect. And also today, I think the most telling of all the social media rants I've seen was a group of World War II veterans who had gone to Washington to go to the memorial and were turned away. These are ordinary Americans, and that's going to really upset ordinary folk who probably might not be politically engaged like other Americans. So there is a huge flow-on effect of what's happened in Washington.
Absolutely. I gather the worst-case scenario could shave about a percentage point off GDP if it were to last for that kind of the sort of distance we saw.
And the dollar's
the last time
already
it happened. Dollar's already taking a dive. Pretty alarming stuff. Obamacare very central, though, to this whole sort of party political row. A little earlier today on the station, we heard from Zenyon Dormandy, project director for the US program at Chatham House. Let's hear a little of what she had to say about the Obamacare wrangle.
Taken at its bare bones, essentially, a group of the Republicans do not like an initiative that has been voted through multiple times, that they have tried to stop multiple times. They've tried to stop through the judicial system. They've tried every single mechanism to stop the healthcare bill going through. This is their, I was about to say last gasp, but it probably isn't. They will keep trying to do that. And so they're trying every single mechanism, but they've been voted down and they haven't grasped the fact that they've been voted down and they just have to move on. This is not about some profound statement that they disagree, some kind of big moral argument. If this were about, say, using military in Syria, then you'd say, well, there's a big moral argument that there's a difference on. This is not about that. This is about literally wanting to stop any proposal by Obama going through.
That was Xenia Dormandy. John, you were going to...
Well, this is also about big money. Mm. It's about the broken nature of American democracy. You know, the right wing of the Republican Party and, you know, the Democrats are equally susceptible to this, or to lobbying influences. And of course, who stands to suffer from now competition in the healthcare field? The big insurance companies, the big dominators of the process in the past. They hate this. They've been lobbying like crazy. And, you know, they have an enormous amount of influence in seeing who gets elected, reelected. And remember, American congressmen run every 2 years. It's one thing for an American senator to take a principal position. He knows he has 4, 5, 6 years to kind of machined to process the whole thing. But these guys in the House are really under the gun of lobbyists.
It could come back to really damage these Tea Party Republicans, because they're candidates who campaign on American values, loving America, respecting the system, the traditions that have made America proud for so long. And effectively what they're doing now is they're hurting that country. They've lost that battle in the parliament that they lobby so strongly for and talk about supporting, and now they're effectively hurting the Americans who have supported them. It's a big gamble, and I think it could have huge consequences at a grassroots level.
Well, I was struck by, again, a Politico. You know, Politico is the most influential, probably, group media outlet in Washington. You know, it's really kind of taken over from the Washington Post and others. And one of their analysts said, just keep in mind, again, it shows again that the national parties have lost so much influence. These House representatives are playing to outside groups. Mm-hmm. They're playing to outside parties that keep pushing them and pushing them. And that's where the real battle is. If these Republicans have to kind of concede, it'll be interesting to see what the payback is to them.
What's the outcome, though? What's the end game? What's the strategy behind the shutdown? Because everyone that I've spoken to, any politically minded friend or colleague, can't tell me what the logic behind this is.
Well, at some point, public opinion. I mean, if public opinion is so angry and vents that anger toward these Republicans who are holding up the whole process, then at some point they have to cave.
What about the attitude of the international community? And Brett, it's interesting, if you're an international correspondent, you know, the perceptions that people have internationally is very important. Plainly, it seems at the moment, domestic politics is blinding many in the US, even the big important people who are going to make these key decisions, to that reality. What do you think the rest of the world makes of this? I mean, John alluded to, you know, it should have been a day for celebration. Instead, it's a day of regret. Correspondents around the world, you know, Figaro in France today said the US is being humiliated by the inability of people in its political system. Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung in Germany saying this failure casts a dark shadow on the next important row. Are America at risk of dealing a really serious long-term blow to how the rest of the world views them? They're supposed to be taking the lead.
Well, it's damaging and it's embarrassing, but people in Australia and people in Britain, for us, I guess, even stepping one step further back, we've had healthcare systems, we've had that support for some time. So a lot of people in Australia, for example, cannot understand why there isn't that same system in place in the United States. And my next door neighbour here is American, and I walked out and saw them this morning. They said, can you believe it? It's finally the day, as you were saying earlier, and now we're talking about all these monuments being shut down. But globally, I think that the people that I'm speaking to are saying that it more reflects on the system. We've seen in the last 2 weeks, the vote on Syria, there's a sense of chaos and disunity, which is never a good look for any government. And I think that Obama is certainly on the back foot there, trying to, I guess, govern as the president with all of these power plays going on Capitol Hill. But look, I think the big thing is how this will be resolved, if it can be resolved. At the moment, I don't think it's a huge crisis internationally, but I think it certainly has the potential to develop into one if it isn't resolved swiftly and decisively by the president.
You know, there is a swing to the right in a lot of parts of the world, and certainly Norway now is a right-wing government. A lot of people could, from the outside, saying, you know, this is real democracy. This is bringing,
and that's true.
This is bringing under control a powerful president. I wish we could do that with our prime minister instead of being ruled by the dominant party in a parliamentary system. I wish we could hold up legislation. I wish we could exert influence. So I don't, you know, it would be interesting to see how it plays out in some parts of the world that are also shifting to the right.
But it also looks a bit like holding the government around, which is effectively what's happening. It looks a bit like sour grapes, where we've lost and this is, we're just going to make you suffer now, effectively. And I think that it reflects badly on both Republicans and Democrats.
It also shows how far American politics have swung to the right, though. Again, the idea that in this country, the Tories they're not saying we're going to do away with the national health care system, as they are in the United States, trying to stop it. They're talking about making more commitments about making your GP available to you for longer periods of the day. Canada, where I spent a long period of time, again, celebrates its national health care system, wants to make some changes and everything. But they all find American politics have just shifted so far to the right on social issues.
Just briefly, we're going to talk a bit more about UK politics in a moment and a bit more of a media angle. I just wondered on that media point very briefly, John, what about the role of the press in particular in the US when it comes to trying to unpick this and ensuring that there's actual political debate? People are talking about the issues and it's not just a partisan row. Do they do a good enough job?
No, because there isn't a public service broadcaster of any consequence. And in broadcasting, there is no regulation. So the broadcasters play the roles that tabloids and newspapers do here. They're ideological. So you don't get a kind of clear, impartial explanation in broadcasting. You might get it on PBS, but it reaches very few listeners or viewers. You probably get it on National Public Radio, if any place. But in general, broad terms, apart from maybe the nightly news, on cable television, which is the thing that's most influential, you're reinforcing your right-wing views, you're reinforcing your left-wing views. The papers, of course, you know, the New York Times, the very good papers are still doing good reporting on this. But again, we know the waning influence of newspapers in the public debate.
So there. Maybe being shouted down. We'll talk a bit more about the media side of things in just a minute. You're with Aperitivo, here with me, Tom Edwards, alongside John Owen and Brett Mason. When we return, we'll ask what happens when indeed the media turns even nastier than usual here in the UK and in Australia. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me, John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University London, and Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. It's party conference season here in the UK. It's often good times for the Whitehall chroniclers. lots of ranting and raving for them to get very excited about. Sometimes, though, the stories in the press go a little beyond that sort of parliamentary parochial into, well, sometimes it's just frankly not cricket. One such story this week that's dominating the UK media is Labour leader Ed Miliband's run-in with the Daily Mail. The Mail picked a fight with a so-called expose of Miliband's father's true views, the views they claim of someone who hated Britain. Ed fought back, galvanised by the paper's failure to apologise and indeed by their upping the ante by repeating the allegations about his father, who was a well-known Marxist academic. John, if I can start with you, it's perhaps no surprise that the Mail's picking a fight with a sort of prominent left-winger, even one beyond the grave. But this particular episode, has that gone beyond the usual expectations, targeting a son as well as a prominent politician? Is this a new and unacceptable step?
Well, I think you need to put in the context of what's going on around Ed Miliband. First of all, he had a very successful Labour Party conference, made some very daring, bold proposals. The energy proposal, his popularity shot up 11 points right now over the Tories. Paul Dacre and the Daily Mail do not want Ed Miliband and Labour back in number 10. And the second part of that context is we're right on the cusp of a final decision about which way press regulation is going to go in this country. Who was the first to embrace a press regulator and to go after the Murdoch chain? It was Ed Miliband. So there's a little payback time here. Now, you could argue, have they gone too far in this? Well, from the public standpoint, I think they're going to find out they have. And you know, this is being played out where it should, in the public arena. The Daily Mail has a right to do what it's doing. But they now are getting also a backlash, I think, from what they've tried to do. So let's play it out, and good on Ed Miliband for taking on the Daily Mail. He's not suing. He's not pouting. He's playing aggressively in the public arena.
Brett, we'll ask you a little more about Australia. We saw quite a vitriolic campaign at times in the last few months. Let's just hear very briefly from Ed Miliband. This was when he sort of came back fighting. Let's hear what he had to say.
It's perfectly legitimate for the newspaper, the Daily Mail, to talk about my father's politics. But when they say that he hated Britain, I was not willing to put up with that because my father loved Britain. My father served in the Royal Navy. He was a refugee who came here. He found security in this country. He took great comfort from what this country offered him. And I'm speaking out as a son. And I was appalled when I read the Daily Mail on Saturday and I saw them saying he hated Britain. It's a lie. I'm even more appalled that they've repeated that lie today and they've gone further and described my father's legacy as evil. Evil is a word reserved for particular cases, and I wasn't willing to let that stand, and that's why I've spoken out, and that's why I've said what I've said, and I'm speaking out on behalf of my family. I expect to get criticised. That comes with the territory. That's absolutely fine. That's the way it should be. But I'm not willing to let my father's good name be besmirched and undermined in the way that the Daily Mail are doing.
But I just wondered, do you think this is fairly tame stuff given some of the vitriol we saw during the Aussie campaign? Or do you think this one would still have played very badly for whoever was responsible, even had it appeared during the worst excesses of the last few months?
Well, there's a very simple rule in journalism. If you ever have to explain to your audience why a story is in the public interest, it probably isn't, or it's certainly not serving the purpose it should. And I think that that's what we're seeing here very clearly, the Daily Mail giving Mr. Miliband the right of reply and then effectively swatting it back down. But I think readers around the world, in America, here in Britain, and certainly at home in Australia, are really sick and tired of the media telling them their opinion. And that's always been there, and every media organisation has a right to have an opinion and to editorialise, but that needs to be clearly differentiated between news coverage and opinion. Even people who read the Daily Mail because they agree with that viewpoint, or they read The Guardian or whatever newspaper they consume, they're sick and tired of that objectivity being removed. That's what I'm finding all around the world. And certainly in Australia, I think people are crying out for news coverage that is just that. The agenda is based on the story of the day. They don't go into an editorial meeting and say, here's our agenda, find the story to suit that. And in Australia, over the course of our federal election, we saw by Australian standards, quite an extraordinary campaign launched that was highly criticised, equally defended by News Limited that they weren't running a campaign, that their editorial coverage wasn't compromised, but a real change in how Australian election campaigns are covered, and it surprised a lot of people. And the interesting thing was, if the campaign was designed to influence Australian opinion, it seems to have had the reverse effect. It actually seems to have alienated and, quite frankly, really annoyed a lot of consumers of the media.
And do you think we end up losing sight? I mean, did it in Australia, some of the key campaign issues, were they lost in this fury? There was so much invective. It became very personal. I mean, going right back even to the ousting of Julia Gillard, there was always a lot of claim about this is just misogyny and the media were complicit or they weren't. Did we lose sight of the fundamentals?
If you asked, surveyed 50 Australians and asked them what policies the last election was contested on, I think many would struggle to tell you articulately. They could tell you about the gaffes and about the personal attacks and about questions of personality and of morals and of upstanding. But when it gets to the substance of the politics, very few people would have consumed that. So much of the media agenda during the election was driven by personalities and by opinion about people's characters, what they stand for, what they're about, which is all important. But given in context of news coverage, it got lost. There was so much more opinion and very little coverage of actual policies. And as journalists, that's our responsibility. And I think that there's been a huge outcry because of that. And the personal nature, particularly the former Prime Minister Julia Gillard was subjected to, our first female Prime Minister, who was asked the most extraordinary questions on live on television, on radio, that a male Prime Minister would never be subjected to. In my opinion, a very low point in Australian journalism.
John, just briefly, do you think this then is an international problem? We see sort of similar sorts of issues cropping up in the US, in Australia, here in the UK, all throughout certainly the Western world. Is it an international problem that there's too much sort of media? It foments all of this rage and fury. It's often very short term, and we're losing sight of good objective coverage. We're not doing exactly what Brett alluded to there, helping people actually find out what's important.
Well, I mean, we just live in a 24/7 Twitter world. I mean, I don't think there's no going back on this. I mean, this is just the world we live in. The kind of ferocious campaigns, the kind of use of media, the counterattacks, the use of social media to try to blunt it, that is just the world we're into. I do think, though, and this is spoken by someone who believes in public service broadcasting, I think there has to be some public space for impartial coverage. And this is the role traditionally the ABC has played, that my CBC, the BBC, and also Channel 4, ITV. There's a history and culture here of public service broadcasters. I think that is being lost in a lot of countries. And I think public discourse is the worst for it.
But in the last campaign in Australia, what was extraordinary, we have a self-regulation model of newspapers, the Australian Press Council. So the newspapers regulate themselves effectively. The leader of that organisation, there was such a level of backlash during the election campaign. He wrote to every newspaper editor reminding them of their obligations under the code, which is extraordinary because the APC has, as far as I'm aware, has not ever had to do that before. There was such a level of shock. The first day of the election campaign, one front page said, we can finally vote these guys out of government, which is fine. Every newspaper can editorialise and state an opinion, but comparisons about coverage of the coalition versus Labor at the end of the campaign showed that there was a huge disparity between the two, and it was clearly noticed by the readers of that paper. So the own readership of this publication or these publications were crying out to the APC before the election was even over, forcing this letter to be sent to all editors, which has not happened before in Australian history. And I think the newspapers will really look, because all this debate is continuing now post the election. People are discussing about the role of the media. And as I said earlier, the real sense that I'm getting is less opinion, give us the facts and allow us to then debate that on Twitter, on social media. We'll have that discussion once we know the facts. And I think that there's a real hunger for that all around the world. I think the media is sort of losing its way slightly, and certainly during the extreme during the recent campaign in Australia.
Maybe it's time that we
or draw a line in the sand. Gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. John Owen from City University and the Frontline Club, Brett Mason from SBS World News Australia. Thank you both very much for joining me here on Aperitivo today.
Cheers.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk photography in just a moment, and we'll preview what's coming up later today. Before all of that, though, here's Paul Osborne with the World News headlines.
President Obama has said the United States government will not be held to ransom. He's spoken in the last half hour as the US government shutdown continues. Up to a million federal employees have been forced to take immediate unpaid leave because Congress has not been able to agree on a budget. An international team is now on the ground in Syria to oversee the destruction of the country's chemical weapons stockpiles. It's thought the Syrian regime has more than 1,000 tons of toxic agents. It's promised full cooperation with the disarmament team, which is there after an agreement between the US and Russia, which was sanctioned by the UN. A week after authorities in Kenya moved to end the siege at a shopping mall in Nairobi, religious leaders have been saying prayers for the 67 people who died. The Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, told the multi-faith service that religion would unite rather than divide the country. An MP from the main opposition party in Bangladesh has been sentenced to death for war crimes dating back to the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. Salahuddin Kader Chowdhury is the first member of the Bangladesh National Party to be tried by the court. And it looks like senior members of Silvio Berlusconi's party will ignore his call to topple Italy's coalition government. His deputy in the Party of Freedom has said MPs should support the Prime Minister in a confidence vote due to be held on Wednesday. Mr. Berlusconi ordered his ministers to resign at the weekend, threatening to topple the government. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Welcome back to Aperitivo, live on Monocle 24. It's 21:36 in Moscow, 18:36 in London, 14:36 in Rio. Each day on the show, as you hopefully know by now, we leave the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House and head down to the equally well-appointed Monocle Cafe, just round the corner on Chilton Street. In today's show, we meet one of our neighbours. Kathleen Fox-Davis is the Associate Director of the Atlas Gallery in Marylebone, almost literally just a hop from Midori House. In the gallery right now is a new exhibition, True Colours, a look at boundary-pushing colour photography through the years. Well, I'm very happy to say Kathleen's at the cafe right now with our own Steve Bloomfield. Steve, it's over to you.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's a little bit more of a hop, I think, over the road to the gallery, but we've gone a little bit further down the road to the cafe. Kathleen Fox-Davis is here with us. Kathleen, welcome to Aperitivo.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's start by talking about the current exhibition, True Colours, which is out at the moment, and then we can lead on to the one that's starting next week, because there's a link between them. But let's start with the one that's on at the moment. Now, Atlas Gallery, for those that don't know it, is really known for its photography. And in this exhibition, you're trying to start to take your work into a little bit of a new direction.
Yes, as of last summer, 2012, we launched the concept of Atlas Contemporary, where we focus our program, at least three shows a year, on new, up-and-coming, emerging contemporary artists, which is something the gallery has never focused on before. True Colors exhibition is a way of tying together the history of the gallery with the new artists that we have brought on in the format of color, which is seen as contemporary and more modern than the black and white pieces that we normally would exhibit.
And one of those artists that you've got in the current exhibition is Paolo Ventura. Talk to us about the next project you're doing with Paolo Ventura, because it's photography, but it's slightly different, isn't it?
Yes, Paolo Ventura has always been quite unique as a photographer, and I use that word loosely because he's much more of an artist. It's the concept. It starts with the idea, and then it's a drawing, and he builds the buildings, he creates sets, he actually makes the clothing to go on the models and puts it all together, and the final product is the photograph, but it's almost just proof of everything else that he has done. So it really is a conceptual work that he's creating. The works that that we have in the True Colors exhibition are from his Winter Stories series, which was published in 2008 and then again in 2010 as an entire series. There are beautiful pieces. It's really the base of where this artist started and where his collecting body know his work. It's the work they recognize. The Infinite City, which opens on the 10th of October at Atlas Gallery, is a departure and quite an exciting contemporary departure in which he's creating the concept of the unique in the photograph. Each piece is a Polaroid that has been hand-painted, hand-drawn on, and it's completely void of the characters that you would that give that whimsical notion to his work. So it really is a new way of looking at Paolo Ventura as a photography artist.
And he's got a very interesting background as well, doesn't he? Because he's from Milan, and his father was, you know, it produced children's books. And it's funny, when you look at, you know, the work that he's doing here, you can almost sort of see that there's a slight sort of Doll's House element to these drawings based on the pictures, aren't there?
Absolutely. His father was a children's book illustrator, and Paolo grew up in this incredibly creative environment where the his hero and his idol didn't go to work, stayed at home and made his career as drawing with his children. So both Paolo and his brother are both incredibly creative as adults, and it's something that is really wonderful to see coming through in Paolo's own work, this his own heritage of where he's coming from. He's continuing that tradition with his own son, who's 5 years old, called Primo, who he actually uses as a character, who he dresses up and play acts out these narratives in his story series, which we'll also be showing in the gallery. So it is a really wonderful family tradition that you're seeing come through in his fine art.
From father to son to son again. And let's talk a little bit about the gallery itself, because, you're an international gallery, and yet it's a gallery space that you can often just walk past and not really quite notice it's there. To give a sense of it, you've got a newsagent a couple of doors down. There's a woodwind shop just round the corner. It's quite a unique little space, isn't it?
I think unique is the right word. I like to say destination or hidden gem. Atlas Gallery is an incredibly approachable space, almost operating as a shop rather than an international fine art gallery. And I think that that's part of its charm. It allows a huge variety of people to feel comfortable walking through our doors, looking at the pictures on the wall, asking questions that you'd never see in a white box space gallery. Even though we do exhibit all over the world in international art fairs, put up huge exhibitions that when we sell to our clients and they then come to visit us in London are a little bit shocked at us working out of quite a small operation. But it works for us.
It certainly does. And when you look at the future for Atlas Galleries, you know, as you're saying, you're taking a slightly different direction. It's been known for its photography quite straight, I guess, for a while. How do you see the gallery developing over the sort of the coming months?
Well, 2014 is seeing Atlas Gallery's 20th anniversary, and also big changes for the gallery. As I said before, about a year ago, we launched the concept of Atlas Contemporary, which in the future will actually become its own space that will be dedicated to these contemporary artists that will have a wall space for us to allow viewing of the large-scale pieces that we can't accommodate in our space now. Atlas has always been known quite strongly for its strength in the vintage photography market, photojournalism, things that wouldn't be considered necessarily fine art because photography wasn't considered that at the time. And there's a real specialism there. And we're now branching out into a younger audience, a younger artist, and it's actually quite exciting.
Kathleen Fox-Davis, thank you very much indeed, and best of luck with everything at Atlas Galleries. Tom, back to you in the studio.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve. As if you needed another reason to visit Marylebone, as well as the Monocle Cafe, Atlas Gallery. Why not strike two birds with one stone? Pay a visit. My thanks to Steve and to Kathleen. Up next on Aperitivo, we're off to the movies, Georgian style. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Somalia has been a failed state for more than two decades, and if it's going to recover, then the airport in Mogadishu will play a key role.
Just a few years ago, the airport was nothing more than a military airbase and a target for mortars fired from nearby neighbourhoods that were under the control of Islamic insurgents. Now, there are daily scheduled passenger flights. But if you're not familiar with Somalia, then you'll still be in for a shock. This is not Heathrow, nor Schiphol. It's Mogadishu, and while things are getting better, the improvement is relative.
Words by Tristan McConnell, images by Pete Muller. Photo reportage at its best. Now playing on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. It's 1845 here in London. We've all heard of Hollywood, Bollywood, France renowned for brilliant art house films, but few people perhaps have ever sat down to watch a Georgian film. And yet during the years of the USSR, some of the greatest films to come out of the Soviet bloc were produced and filmed in Georgia. The country has an amazing history of filmmaking going back over a century. After the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, Georgian film fell into decline, but now a new generation of filmmakers in the country has emerged, and they are bolder and more assured even than their illustrious predecessors. They're winning awards and garnering praise from all points of the globe. And, interestingly, the vast majority of them are women. Monocle's Matt Alagaya went down to the Riverside Studios here in West London to report on the British Georgian Society's third Georgian Film Festival. He sat down with one of the two directors of the festival, Jason Osborne.
The British Georgian Society, which was formed in 2004, decided to have a festival of Georgian films in 2005, which was the first British Georgian Society Georgian Film Festival. And they showed some of the new films that had started to be made, because in the 90s, Georgian film was totally in decline after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And the first shoots of making new films coincided with the election of President Saakashvili, and they started making films, and it's grown in the last 10 years.
This recent revival has seen Georgian film return to the forefront of international cinema. But what makes Georgian directors and their films so special?
I think they make good films, first of all. They're different, they're unique. Their style is probably not as narrative-driven as we're used to, but that allows for a lot of interesting juxtapositions. And Georgia is also one of the most beautiful countries in the world, so the actual visual quality of Georgia itself is reflected in the films. And as well as that, the Georgian character is very much about showing yourself very strongly. So they're great extroverts. They like acting very much, and so they're naturally very suited to be in films.
One of the things that immediately strikes you when you look at the lineup for this year's festival is just how many of the directors represented are women. Nina Anjaparidze, director of the Tbilisi International Film Festival, explains why they deserve our attention.
At the beginning of the 21st century, in the Georgian cinema appeared a huge wave of young female filmmakers, and they illustrated in their films endless problems of Georgia during that time period, and they have very strong, very hard principles and problems. And I was thinking that it would be interesting for the bigger society, like British society, to bring our problems, our missions, our message. Among the big famous film directors are very interesting female directors, and they left important trace in the development of Georgian cinemas, and they have received a lot of prestigious awards in different international film festivals around the world.
One of the directors who has won awards around the world is Tina Gurciani.
For its original vision, sense of place, luminous humanity, and for having the best title in the festival, the directing award goes to Tina Teen Gurciani for The Machine, which makes everything disappear.
I'm joined now by Tina Gurciani, whose film
The Machine Which Makes Everything Disappear won the World Cinema Directing Award at the 2013 Sundance Festival. What did it feel like to see your film win that award?
I'm very happy about it, and I did not have any expectation. Festival success is one thing, but we got also theatrical release in many countries, and it was great.
One thing I've been struck by this whole festival, there are so many female filmmakers in Georgia. Why do you think that is?
We have a lot of filmmakers who are not female, but the last time women got more success, I don't know why, but I think because we have this time of challenges, maybe the women are stronger or they are more rebellious in a way, I don't know. I never thought about this because for me it was never difficult to make film as woman filmmaker, and I got very often questions like this, how difficult is it in this world to survive as a woman filmmaker, but I think it's for everybody not so easy, and it does not make difference so much.
Another filmmaker who has been making waves internationally with her film Salt White is Keti Machavariani. She also speaks about the success of female filmmakers in Georgia.
With Salt White, I was traveling a lot, and I was attending female director film festivals, and I was asked as well that if it's a good place for female film directors, and I answered that it's a best place because I never felt that I'm different from male film directors, so I can fulfill my projects as they are doing at the same level. Our share in Georgian film industry is about 90%. I don't know exactly what's the reason, because last 17 years, in every decade, there was just one or two female film directors. And right now, even in this festival, you can see so many young female filmmakers are attending and presenting their works. And there are coming new projects, which I hope will be screened during the next edition of the festival.
So it seems the revival of Georgian cinema is set to continue, and the amazing success of female directors too. Jason Osborne predicts the future of the industry.
Well, I think it's quite an interesting point because, first of all, quite a few of the films have a sort of, for want of a better word, a post-Soviet legacy. Obviously, they had the war in 2008 with Russia, but the whole threat of Russia, the whole what it meant to be part of the Soviet empire, is very much ingrained in, first of all, obviously in an older generation, but because of all the troubles in the 90s, in the current generation as well. Under the Soviet times, the Georgians were one of the main filmmakers in all the Soviet-based countries. But post then, it's been a revival, and the various new films that have won prizes all over the world. So moving on from that Soviet legacy to going back to what it is to be a Georgian again, I think will be a very interesting time in Georgian filmmaking.
For Monocle, in London, I'm Matt Alagaya.
You are listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we go, I've got some more treats for you. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the producers of, respectively, this evening's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily, Annabelle Bly and Daphne Denny. Join me here in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Dom.
Hi, Tom.
Let's start. Well, let's tackle it in chronological order, shall we? Globalist Asia, of course, 2000 hours. Annabelle, if I were to put you on the spot, what's going to be the highlight of that programme?
The highlight is definitely one to wait for. It's coming in the second half. We've got a semiotic special.
Oh, I like the sound of it.
Yeah, so we'll be analysing letters and numbers and just various symbolisms. In
like
the way
it.
That we communicate.
Now, this is good because, I know a little about this, which you would hope. Indeed, the number 64, pregnant with so much meaning, particularly in China, of course.
Yes, 64 specifically, which put together equals 64.
I was just jumping to the end of that process.
Yeah, so today is China's 64th birthday, well, the 64th birthday of the People's Republic of China. However, 64 is also June the 4th in Chinese, which was the date of the Tiananmen Square crackdown in 1989.
Now, am I right in thinking that it's actually been very difficult even to sort of search on search engines, that kind of thing, for 6-4? How are they sort of getting around this? Because presumably that's rather awkward to, on one hand, celebrate something that for so often has been seen as rather a sort of dark secret.
Yep, so normally 6-4 would be heavily filtered, either heavily filtered in terms of your search results or just completely blocked. But today they've had to completely relax things, and dissidents across the internet have been having a field day.
So that's our numbers. What about our letters? You did mention it's both numerical and letter-based as well.
Yeah, we'll be having a look at the letter X, which is just one of the letters that is now going to start being used in Turkey as a result of Prime Minister Erdogan's political reforms.
Intriguing. It's another, I guess, letter that's sort of pregnant with meaning, isn't it? X-rated. X-ray.
Yeah, it's a fun one. Some languages miss out on it, but...
I know. How would they have referred to Malcolm X, I wonder? Be a struggle.
Who knows?
Intriguing stuff. That's the semiotic special. I definitely like the themed episode. Daphne, what about the daily? Can you measure up to that?
I'm not... Well, actually, yes. I will say
yes. I like it.
Yes.
Be confident.
I will be confident. I would say the most interesting part of our show is going to be at the top. It's the story of Jim the Mint, the grandfather of the current shutdown. He's the man who orchestrated the government shutdown and the man who asked for Republicans to cut their funding to Obamacare to put the government on the spot.
It's extraordinary. We were talking earlier in the program with my guests about the shutdown, how you know people saw it coming. They didn't seem to be able to sidestep it. It's incredible to think, really, that there can be one malevolent person sort of behind such a development. But I guess that's what makes Jim DeMint so intriguing.
Well, he was called crazy. You know, he quit the Senate in January to become the president of the Heritage Foundation and become a lobbyist. At the time, people were just wondering why he was doing that. And then he went around and just said, guys, we can just cut this funding. And if we do that, it's really, really going to hurt Obama. And he's the man who orchestrated it. At first, everyone thought he was crazy, and now it's happening.
Now they still maybe think he's crazy, but they've maybe got a little bit of admiration for
but they followed him.
What else were you packing into tonight's daily? You know, it's always one of my favourite programmes.
I quite like it too, I have to say. Well, we'll be talking about Rouhani wanting to reopen direct flights between the United States and Iran. So we're just going to see how that may impact Iran. Obviously, you know, airplane parts in Iran are really, really old because there's been embargoes on any type of airplane parts for ages. So we're just going to be talking to our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, and Mirahad Verdinejad, who comes often to the show and who will be talking about the impact specifically for Iran. Yeah.
With that development. Intriguing stuff. And it's interesting, isn't it? Those are the kind of things I guess you often forget about, how a nation can be in some respects isolated. You know, it's literal as well as metaphorical in many cases. Annabelle, just briefly, what if I give you the final word? If we return to the Globus Asia, 2000 hours. What else? Apart from our semiotics, should we really just not look beyond the celebration of semiotics today?
We do have a fairly serious and important, some important issues to cover in our first half. Japan has announced today huge plans to raise taxes, which are going to be affecting people significantly. So we'll be asking how Japanese society will be affected. And we will also be going to Bangladesh, where they have had quite a serious sentencing today of one of their politicians. So we've got a show of two halves, but
absolutely,
it's worth listening.
Hard-hitting stuff at the top and semiotic special at the bottom. Lovely stuff. That's Annabelle Bly and Daphne Denny. Thank you both very much for coming to join me here on Aperitivo today. That is all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to my special guests, John Owen and Brett Mason, of course. Today's show was expertly produced by Daniel Jacopelli, research by James Bullock and Matt Alagoya, and our studio manager was the smooth operator known as Chris Fitch. Next up after the headlines is Section D, our design programme. Here's a taster of what's to come.
We really love to work with and collaborate with different designers, and for us what's really, really interesting is to have a design partnership which could be based on any different type of skill.
then at 20:00 hours London time, as you've been hearing, you'll be in the very capable hands of Anna Boblai with Globalist Asia. A little later, 22:00, equally welcoming the embrace of Daphne Denis with the Monocle Daily at 22:00. This show will be back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 18:00 hours London time if you needed reminding. But from this edition of Aperitivo, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.